you heard.
The headlines. With more than 90% of ballots counted in Israel's elections, the results point to another possible stalemate. A roadside bomb hits a convoy belonging to the U.S.-led coalition forces in southern Iraq. And also, Taiwan says it has begun mass production of a long-range missile and is developing three other models amid growing tensions with China. Hello and welcome, everybody. Near complete results from Israel's fourth snap elections in 2 years indicate another political deadlock with no clear path to a majority for any party. Election officials say 46,000 absentee ballots have been counted overnight, but they slightly shifted the electoral makeup. As of Thursday morning, over 4 million votes had been counted. This amounts to 91.6% of all ballots cast in Tuesday's elections, which saw the lowest turnout since 2013. The results have so far suggested that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's Likud party would win 30 seats in the 120-seat Knesset. This means that his party will fail to secure the required 61 seats for forming a cabinet, even if it forms a coalition with political allies. Mona Kandil says the final results of Israel's snap elections may not be announced until Saturday night.
It's not easy for them that every couple of months they go and cast their ballots. But it seems, according to experts, that the Israelis, not all of them, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is still receiving support from the settler community and from right-wing supporters. But till the moment, according to the old Israeli televisions, there is no clear victor has emerged in Israel's elections, with nearly, as you have mentioned, 90% of ballots counted in Tuesday's vote of the fourth election. It's the first time in the Israeli history. So neither Netanyahu nor his opponents appear to have a secure path to form a majority coalition needed to win. Now, the scales could tip as more votes are counted in the coming days, so the final results will not emerge Thursday. It could be on Friday morning or even till Saturday night.
A convoy belonging to the U.S.-led military coalition has been targeted in the southern Iraqi province of Diwania. Iraqi security sources say the convoy carrying logistical equipment was targeted with a roadside bomb. No casualty or damage has been reported so far. There's been no immediate claim of responsibility. Either American forces and their logistic convoys have been targeted frequently in Iraq in recent months amid growing anti-U.S. sentiments there. Anger mounted after the U.S. assassination of top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani and senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in January last year. A United Nations special rapporteur says a top Saudi official has issued a death threat against her for investigating the murder of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi. She published a 100-page report in June 2019 concluding that there was credible evidence the Saudi crown prince and other officials were liable for the killing. Khashoggi was killed and dismembered inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in October 2018.
Back in 2018, Jamal Khashoggi, a journalist and critic of the Saudi government, was murdered after he entered Saudi Arabia's consulate in Istanbul, Turkey. Saudi Arabia initially denied any knowledge of Khashoggi's fate, as the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman told Bloomberg News that the journalist left the consulate shortly after he entered and that there is nothing to hide. However, recordings and other evidence gathered by Turkish authorities revealed how a team of Saudi agents subdued, killed, and then dismembered the journalist inside the diplomatic mission. In February, a long-awaited U.S. intelligence report also concluded that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman approved and probably ordered the assassination of Khashoggi. but Washington stopped short of targeting bin Salman with financial or other sanctions. The report released in June 2019 by the UN Special Rapporteur Agnes Callamard concluded that there was credible evidence that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and other senior officials were behind Khashoggi's assassination and called the murder an international crime. Lately, Callamard has revealed she was threatened by the Saudis for her role in the Khashoggi investigation. She said a colleague alerted her that a Saudi official had threatened to have her taken care of. The UN Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial, Summary, and Arbitrary Killings says the officials in the room had considered the remarks as a death threat. Callamard, who will this month take on her new post as the Secretary General of Amnesty International, had previously slammed the international community for their failure to ensure justice in Khashoggi's assassination.
Effectively, we see the United Nations is powerless because it is in the hands of the superpower, and particularly the United States, that has the veto decision on anything that goes against its own interest.
Well, a U.S. intelligence report in February revealed that Mohammed bin Salman directly approved the killing of Jamal Khashoggi in October 2018. The U.S. administration of President Joe Biden has failed to directly penalize the Saudi crown prince. Biden has rejected the idea of punishing bin Salman, for Washington and Riyadh have an alliance. That's why Riyadh is the largest arms importer in the world. During the past 5 years, 24% of the U.S. arms exports went to Saudi Arabia.
A declassified U.S. intelligence report revealed that Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, had ordered the gruesome killing of Saudi opposition journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The Biden administration only announced sanctions recently and visa bans on the citizens involved in Khashoggi's murder, but stopped short of imposing sanctions on the Crown Prince himself. That is why the U.S. President Joe Biden rejected the idea of holding bin Salman accountable for the murder. He stated that Washington has an alliance with Riyadh and cannot punish its head of state. Indeed, Washington's alliance with Riyadh is a lucrative one. The U.S. has accounted for 37% of global arms exports in the world between 2016 and 2020, making it the largest arms exporter in the last 5 years. A major chunk of that goes to Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is the biggest arms importer in the world and alone accounted for 24% of total U.S. arms exports during the same period. Weapons which have been used in Yemen war to kill thousands of innocent children and civilians and cause the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
The United States is protecting Saudi Arabia, violation of human rights and all genocidal crime that Saudi Arabia is doing, not only against the dissident, but also in Yemen.
The U.S. President Joe Biden has refused to penalize the Saudi Crown Prince, despite the fact that he promised to make Saudi Arabia a pariah state for Khashoggi's killing and other abuses during his 2020 presidential campaign. While the U.S. benefits from its lucrative alliance with the Saudis, it seems that the green dollars have lured Washington to turn a blind eye to Riyadh's crimes.
Moving on, Iran's parliament speaker has slammed the United States for its unilateral sanctions against the Islamic Republic and some other countries.
If the use of force, fear, and pressure with the aim of reaching political goals is considered as a key element in the definition of terrorism, then undoubtedly the United States' imposition of unilateral and tyrannical sanctions against certain parts of the world, including the people of Iran, is a clear-cut example of economic terrorism.
Talibov also said Washington's assassination of top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani last year amounts to state terrorism. He made the remarks during a virtual conference of parliament speakers from Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Turkey, China, and Russia on combating terrorism. There he condemned the separation of terrorists into good and bad ones by some countries. The top Iranian parliamentarian said the U.S. and Israel are making such differentiations with the aim of exploiting terror groups to achieve their own agenda. Khalibaf also slammed the Israeli regime for preventing the import of COVID-19 vaccines into the occupied Palestinian territory, saying this amounts to a crime against humanity. China has pledged to make efforts to safeguard the Iran nuclear deal and defend, quote, legitimate interests of Sino-Iranian relations. The Commerce Ministry's spokesman made the remarks during a briefing. Gao Feng said his country has not received notices of sanctions on Iranian oil from the new U.S. administration. This as the Biden administration has said it will hold off on lifting sanctions unless Tehran comes back to full compliance with the 2015 deal. Tehran has rejected Washington's demand, saying it was the U.S. that abandoned the U.N.-endorsed accord and therefore it needs to take the first step. Former U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew from the deal in 2018 and pledged to bring Iran's oil exports down to zero through his so-called maximum pressure campaign, but he never achieved the goal.
While on a visit to Europe, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has been discussing the Iran nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, with senior EU officials.
I welcome the Secretary's reaffirmation that the U.S. is ready to engage and the prospects of a U.S. return to the JCPOA.
For his part, Blinken seemed only interested in spinning anti-Iran rhetoric following meetings at the European Commission Brussels.
We talked about our shared goal of preventing Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons.
Earlier at NATO headquarters in the Belgian capital, Blinken spoke at greater length on the subject.
To look at how we might come back to compliance with the JCPOA, we said yes, and to date, Iran has chosen not to engage. So, as we've said, the ball is really in their court.
Even Iran's harshest critics might find Blinken's position difficult to grasp. After all, it was the U.S. that withdrew from the agreement in 2018, at a time when Iran was in full compliance, according to the International Atomic Energy Agency. Many analysts believe Joe Biden's administration is bowing to pressure from Tel Aviv to not engage with Iran. It has been suggested, however, that Benjamin Netanyahu does not speak for everyone. The U.S. continues to impose illegal unilateral economic sanctions on Iran, despite the JCPOA having been underpinned by the United Nations. Tehran insists the current deal cannot be renegotiated, and the only fair and legal option for the U.S. is to rejoin the accord without preconditions. As the coordinator of the deal, legal experts say the ball is firmly in the EU's court and not Iran's. According to many analysts, Iran has demonstrated it is unwilling to remain in the JCPOA at all costs. Therefore, they say, the EU is clearly running out of time to save this landmark agreement. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Taiwan says it has begun mass production of a long-range missile and development of three other models as part of its military modernization program aimed at deterring China. Taiwan's defense ministry called having a long-range attack capability a priority. President Tsai Ing-wen confirmed the statement, saying Taiwan needed to develop an asymmetrical deterrent with mobile equipment. Earlier this month, Taipei announced that it has also strengthened its deployment in the disputed South China Sea. Officials said the moves are aimed at confronting what they refer to as China's expansionism. China claims Taiwan is part of its territory under its One China principle. Author and columnist Stainer Tangen says any miscommunication regarding the issue of Taiwan could lead to a massive tragedy in East Asia.
This is close to a declaration of war, at least from Beijing's side. They have been silent so far. I believe they're probably mulling this over. But this is extremely serious. I think, Tsai Ing-wen and her defense minister are testing the waters to see just how far American support will go. The timing is, it's not surprising, given the sharp exchange of words in Alaska, the buildup to that event. With Chinese and Hong Kong officials being blacklisted, Chinese companies being delisted from American bourses, increased activity, warships going up and down the Taiwan Straits, flyovers, et cetera. This goes on and on. Daily vilification of China in the press, accusations of spying, deceit, et cetera. Things are really getting very, very serious. Taiwan is looking to be opportunistic in this, but I think in the end that they may have inadvertently begun what it could is a tragedy of epic proportions that will move American military muscle from its forever war in the Middle East to Southeast Asia.
Several countries have reacted to North Korea's launch of two ballistic missiles into the see near Japan, members of South Korea's National Security Council expressed deep concern over the move. Japanese Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga called it a threat to his country and regional peace and stability, as well as a violation of UN resolutions. Tokyo said one of the missiles flew about 450 kilometers before landing outside Japan's exclusive economic zone. In a statement, the U.S. military said the missile launches highlighted the threat Pyongyang poses to its neighbors and the international community. The statement added the military is monitoring the situation. The launches come just days after American and South Korean officials confirmed the North's firing of two short-range cruise missiles. And a number of European countries are seeing record jumps in their coronavirus numbers as a third wave of the pandemic sweeps through the continent. Poland has reported an all-time high of over 34,000 new COVID-19 infections. The government has announced more restrictions for the next 2 weeks as the country faces a lack of hospital beds and ventilators. Ukraine also posted a record number of new daily cases. The Eastern European country logged 362 fatalities, shattering previous record tallies for a third straight day. In Germany, over 22,500 people contracted COVID-19, the highest daily figure since early January. On Wednesday, the German government backtracked on a plan for further restrictions over Easter amid public backlash. Well, the UK is about to ease the restrictions of its third lockdown. The vaccine rollout is going well, but how hard has the UK been hit by a year of on and off closures? And how shrewd have the government's rescue initiatives been? Some say, when it comes to the economy, the worst is yet to come. Bianca Raimi tells us more in this report.
A moment of silence for more than 126,000 Britons who have died since the UK government announced the UK's first lockdown this time last year. And as the country prepares to exit its third, the government's handling of the crisis is being called into question. Some say the success of the vaccine rollout is being used to obscure just how unprepared the government was and how Britain has been made poorer by poor decision-making. Economists say the lowest income bracket will have to foot the bill, which may exceed £355 billion.
The taxpayer will put almost certainly most of it, and it's 355, but then you've got the next year's borrowing, which be another 234 and another 100 on top of that, getting up to 700-800 a billion. The key point about this is that the whole of their philosophy is based on the idea that the very wealthy will trickle down their wealth to the mass of the population. That never happens.
The Public Accounts Committee said earlier this year the government's lack of economic planning and preparation for a pandemic was astonishing, despite it being one of the top risks identified in the National Risk Register. Billions have been thrown at businesses in danger of going under, and if the borrowers can't repay them, the taxpayer will. There is no way of knowing how many fraudulent claims have been made, and it is forecast many businesses will not be able to repay their debt, so the British public will have to. Throughout the pandemic, the government reassured lenders who were not required to perform any credit or affordability checks by guaranteeing loans 100%. But that can't be said for the British public. That is already reeling from years of declining social mobility and a near decade of rising child poverty. Bianca Rahimi, London.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Bye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Dark Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In this episode, we'll be reviewing award-winning film Terror, directed by David Felix Sutcliffe and Lyric Cabral. Joining me in the studio today, we have Tim Roby, a film critic for the Daily Telegraph, who is also a regular guest on BBC Film 2017 and the UK's Radio 4 film programme, and Raza Nadim, who is head of Muslim Public Affairs Committee UK and who has been involved in anti-Islamophobia campaigning for over 10 years. Now, Terror is the first documentary to place filmmakers on the ground during an active FBI counter-terrorism sting operation. The film delves into the dark world of FBI informants, government surveillance, and the US's so-called war on terror. Thank you both for joining the show. So this film won an award at the 2015 Sundance Film Festival. Tim, if I could start with you, what was your general take on the film?
Well, it held quite a lot of value for me as an expose. Certainly it kind of opened a window on the world of counter-terrorism sting operations, which I had not really witnessed before. It does claim to be the first example of this kind of filmmaking. And I was troubled by it in various ways, but quite productively, I think, on the whole. And it led me in a direction which resolved some of my issues with the initial approach. I thought as it went along, I found that the characters came into closer focus, and I began to understand the issues involved, and it began to really convince me and win me over with its argument, essentially, which is that the FBI have crossed a line since 9/11 and are beginning to criminalise in kind of quite an outlandishly unfair way behaviour which really shouldn't be criminalised.
Mm. And you, Raza, how did you find the film?
I mean, it's the talk of counter-terrorism and informants and, you know, within the Muslim communities, especially within Britain and America. Lots had been written in the past about it. So this really was quite interesting to see it happening in front of you. Really felt like you were on the journey with them as they were following, you know, the protagonists and on the sting operation. So, I mean, in that sense, it was good because it no longer was an academic study or someone just, you know, an article where someone is posing questions saying, have things gone too far? What happens to our liberties, etc.? You were watching it in action. I think from that perspective, it was great. I think also because it showed for people like myself and other Muslim campaigners that this isn't just based on hearsay, this isn't just based on people kind of on conspiracy theories, this is actually happening, and that actually in many cases being done by people who aren't that good. And you're right, a line has been crossed in many ways. So I think for me this was good because it arms us with the argument about how surveillance has gone too far.
I want to talk about a little bit about the beginning of the film. I think it's quite a symbolic scene where we see a little girl singing the national anthem, the US national anthem, and specifically the filmmakers include the lyrics, "Land of the Free, Land of the Brave." Tim, why do you think that was such a significant scene to include in the film?
I think you've sort of answered the question. It very much is a film about freedom and a film about the freedom of expression. Essentially what happens over the course of the film is that some beliefs held by the targets of these sting operations on social media and elsewhere become a basis on which to prosecute them. And I really don't think we should be prosecuting people for beliefs. It actually amounts to thought crime. By the end of the film, I really thought it had made that case very convincingly with especially two of the examples that it chooses in terms of the victims. But then there's also the perpetrator of the sting, the main figure in the film, who is a very interesting and troubled figure in his own right, and clearly has a lot of issues. And really, a lot of the film is asking whether this kind of case should be entrusted over to a personality like that. Very early on, we hear the point made that informants for the FBI can be really quite bad people, because you're having to break faith with a lot of relationships that you build up. And the kind of person who would be willing to do that and willing to essentially betray confidences and friendships in this way, you wonder if they're verging on sociopathy, and I think that is an issue.
That was the actual phrase they used, wasn't it? In the radio thing, you hear them in the discussion. Actually, it is quite sociopathic to be able to build such a close relationship with someone and then kind of stab them in the back, almost, take something out of context or whatever. But also, that the land of the free bit. For me, one thing that really stood out was because it showed that Saeed Sharif, whatever you want to call him, that he believed in the American dream. And he talks about having a bakery, etc., and whatnot, providing for his child, and how this was an avenue to make some money. I think that line also stood out that way because, the American anthem is used in everything in America, right? From sports events to classrooms to whatever, you name it.
That's very true. And I want to pick apart Saeed's character a bit later on.
What is the map on the wall?
Why is the what?
Why is the map on the wall?
Find my locations around here.
Is there significance to the red lines?
Yes. It's regarding the work I do. No, I'm going to give you the picture. I'm going to put them up on here. It'll be better for you because I don't want to explain nothing to you. You got it, that's it. Don't ask no question who they are. I'm giving you something that you shouldn't be seeing anyway. For some reason, they got a big population of Muslims that come from the various countries over there to come to school here. Moroccans, Somalis, Saudis, and then they all go back from where they come from. I don't have no feelings for them. You're making the Islam look bad. You gotta go.
Faraz Zaid's targets were all Muslim from various ethnic backgrounds. What do you think of the way the FBI targets their victims or their targets, and are they justified in doing so?
Well, see, the thing is, the whole argument about racial profiling comes into the equation. I mean, there's a great book called The Muslims Are Coming by Professor Arun Kundani, and he talks about actually how the same tactics that were used with COINTELPRO and the Black Panthers, by the government and by J. Edgar Hoover, were essentially copied and just kind of using a cookie-cutter approach, just put onto the Muslim community, and that actually how they just said, well, if they're Muslims, they're a suspect community, and they were only viewed through the lens of the war on terror. And that's why when he says, because actually he says that clip goes on saying, isn't it strange all your suspects, your targets are Muslims? He goes, yeah, well, what can I say about that? And I mean, he doesn't want to delve more into it, but it's true, the FBI, there have been a disproportionate number of targeting of Muslims, and part of it is, and now we see with Trump as well, that how the CVE operations, the countering violent extremism operations, are focused solely on Muslims. They're seen as the sole perpetrators of terrorism. And that was part, and that kind of really clouded the judgment, and does still cloud the judgment, of security services who only kind of view Muslims and Islam through that lens.
And Tim, the FBI seems to prey on vulnerable targets in this film. What do you make of Saeed's character?
Yeah, I mean, vulnerable is certainly one word for him. He is rather a tragic figure, really. And he's acting almost entirely out of self-interest and expecting to get more profit from this situation than he actually receives. There are these sort of scenes of him complaining that he's not being given enough, literally enough cash in the envelope that he's receiving. He seems disgruntled and oppressed at all times. But he's also very kind of cut-off individual. He's a real sort of solo operator and a loner. There are a few scenes with his family, but on the whole, he's just going solo on these missions. And he seems very disconnected from the Muslim community, except to the degree in the sense of him actually feigning kind of interest in what they're doing and kind of stepping in there and kind of pretending, talking the talk, if you like, just in order to elicit the kind of supposed kind of information about them that the FBI is hoping for. And not only to elicit it, but to kind of coax out beliefs and comments that could be used against them, which they might otherwise not make. And that really is almost the definition of entrapment.
Would you agree with Tim?
Oh, definitely. And I think with Said, I mean, he is a vulnerable character, but also the bitterness comes out of it's so that self-interest, because he actually, in the long term, when you start to analyse what he's doing and what he's hoping to gain, you realise there's actually not much to gain at the end of it, because he has to be aloof from the Muslim community because he's spying on Muslims. But secondly, it's his work has meant, when he has been found out in the past, when you've seen the documentary, it's meant he doesn't form any real bonds. Like, he really is cut off, partly because of his work, and it's just made him a real bitter individual. So when he says, you know, they're giving Muslims a bad name, that for me was an off-the-cuff comment. He doesn't like other Muslims after a while, and that really comes across that he has an issue with other Muslims.
Yeah,
but
definitely.
He also wants that friendship and that community, but he knows he can't get it being in this line of work, but he's chose to be there. Mm. You can see why he's such a troubled individual.
From the film, we learn that 9/11 changed the FBI's tactics when it comes to dealing with criminals. So we find out that before 9/11, the FBI would investigate crimes after they've been committed, but then after 9/11, the FBI sought to try and prevent the crimes from happening. Now, Tim, what are the moral implications of this, and can the FBI prevent a crime from happening before it's even been committed? And in a sense, doesn't that make them complicit in that they're paving the way for that crime to occur?
Well, it's certainly a slippery slope. I mean, if a credible bomb threat were to be issued, then of course they're going to investigate that. That's a crime that they're going to want to prevent. And I think prevention is better than cure in that respect. I mean, let's agree that we would rather that bomb did not go off, almost certainly. But if there's no such bomb, and if they're merely waiting to find what kind of person might one day light the fuse to that bomb, long down the road, then you have to ask them at what point they step in, because if they step in prematurely, that is prosecuting individuals really illegally, I think. And I think in the case of the figures that we find in this film, they are so far away from that end game of actually lighting the fuse, if you like, that really they're being almost encouraged further down the road than they would otherwise go. There is a continuum there, and they are some way down that road, I will concede, because some of the beliefs that they hold would be considered quite unpalatable, I think, to non-Muslims. But nonetheless, this is thought crime if you're going to try and prosecute it.
I mean, in Hollywood films, we're used to seeing the FBI depicted as some kind of sleek and high-technology organization. But what do we learn about their methods in this documentary, Raza?
I think what really comes across is just how human they are, and how in this, like, they are kind of wading through the darkness trying to make sense of this all. They've got an objective, which is stop terrorism. But then from there on out, it's kind of figure out, lads. And it's just so strange because, you know, when he says in that little clip where he says, oh, you know, they go by the book, you're just an individual. You're not an expert in any way, shape or form apart from you're a member of a community, right? And even then an isolated figure at that. And so what, you're the expert now in this relationship with the FBI? It's so strange in the whole thing. And when you're watching, you realize, oh my God, they don't really seem to know much about what they're doing. I mean, like, you know, they're so used to the kind of crime apparatus that they have is to deal with, you know, to deal with crime once it's happened, to deal with petty theft, criminals in that sense. But terrorism, it does, you can just see that they are incompetent in many ways. That's what really comes across for me, that they don't actually know what they're doing. And I think also that with the FBI thing, what you get from the documentary is that actually how they have kind of jumped into the deep end, and now they're trying to stay afloat, but they're struggling. Like, you know, for example, before 9/11, they only had a couple of, was it 1,500
That's right.
informants?
Yeah.
And after 9/11, it goes up to 15,000,
yes.
right? That's ridiculous. I mean, that level, to jump to that scale, and they've not managed it, and that really comes across in the documentary.
You really hope that those 15,000 aren't all like Saeed, because it is the phrase that comes to mind is the blind leading the blind, really, yeah.
So let's now talk about Saeed's target in this film, Khalifa. Tim, how is Khalifa portrayed in this film, and are we made to feel sympathetic to his innocence and him being framed?
Yes, I mean, just to add, the phone number there, the fact that he finds it through one Google and is able to kind of discover that the guy's an informant, I mean, talk about ineptitude, that's kind of the ultimate. But yeah, Khalifa's story in this film is a very valuable additional layer, I think, especially when the filmmakers get access to him personally and start to talk to him. Saeed doesn't know that that's happening. And I think it really it enhances the film's perspective quite a lot, and I think it becomes a much stronger film as soon as he is a main figure in it. Because early on, all we have is the kind of layer of his identity that essentially Saeed is working with, his Facebook page and his social media profile. And some of the stuff he's saying is quite provocative. It is quite leading in a way. You can understand why he, you know, the powers that be might consider him a person of interest, at least. But of course, Saeed then pushes him further down that road, and he becomes very suspicious. And the more we get to know him, actually, the more we discover someone who seems actually a very peaceful individual, with a beef against the US government for sure, with a very sort of particular set of political attitudes. Mm-hmm. But they are completely within the what you would call the not harmful category, and the fact that he is sort of this major figure in this sting, you just wonder, are there not other people they should be looking at really rather more urgently than him? And I think by the end of it, you found him to be a rather sympathetic figure indeed, and someone who's been unfairly blamed for things he hasn't really committed to.
Mm. Well, so how do you think how fair it was to target Khalifa by the FBI?
Well, so the thing is, it's what's come out over the last couple of years is how there's a use, they have profiles that they've made and algorithms that are used for this kind of work. And the reality is, there's no real profile of a terrorist. They come in all different shapes and sizes. And the problem with using algorithms is that you could take any sort of political comment made by a Muslim and say, this leads them to that road, leads them to violence. I mean, and part of the kind of counterterrorism mindset in this country and in America has been that non-violent extremism leads to violent extremism. And in kind of with that net, you end up catching almost anyone that makes any sort of political comment. And you see, that's how he's been caught, really, on that basis. I think one line that really stood out for me is when he says, I knew he was FBI. That bit, I thought, I've had some... I know that kind of... That way, the tone that he used, I've seen that from other Muslims in conversations, where the problem... What this documentary really shows, right, for me, is that it's made Muslims more... they don't trust other Muslims off the back of this, because they feel that there's informants within the community. And you see it all the time. Now, that guy might be a spy. I don't really trust him. He might be undercover, etc. So when he says that, it shows that actually his way... That, you have to be aware of that kind of problem within your community to be thinking that way. And that's what really came across to me in that scene, and generally, at the end, that the issue of spying on Muslims, people are aware of it, and they're wary of it, and it makes them... they don't trust their own fellow Muslims, and within the community you see that breaking apart.
Would you like to jump in there?
Yeah,
Tim?
There's one thing, a question I'm not sure the film really asks, but really you have to consider, in the case of someone like him, if he is put away for a crime like this, you know, when he comes out of jail, what's his attitude going to be? I mean, this is a way to radicalise people more than anything else, I feel.
Mm-hmm. And last 30 seconds to you, Tim, what do you recommend that people watch this?
Yeah, I do think it's a film worth watching. Very much, I hope that there are further investigations done along these lines, because it's something that does need to be revealed to a wide audience. And I think as filmmaking, it is actually extremely well crafted as well. I think the footage they get from both of these major interviews is extremely strong, and kind of correlates very well with their main argument. And yeah, I was impressed with it.
Well, I'm afraid that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and for you. I've been Camila Shambayati.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn, alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects. Thank you.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. My name is Muhammad, and I'm invited by Brother Mahdi to this segment of the program. Today, I'd like to read to you a passage about Islamic lifestyle according to Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. This passage is extracted from a book titled The Life of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Baqir, written by the great Iraqi Muslim historian and scholar Allama Baqir Sharif al-Qurashi. This great Muslim scholar and historian was born in 1344 AH in the city of Najaf. He's well known for his books on the biography and conduct of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. Please stay with me. Imam Abu Ja'far al-Baqir, peace be upon him, was asked about the most ascetic of all the people. So he, peace be upon him, replied, "It is he who pays no attention to the world." Then he was asked, "Who is the most hopeless of all the people?" "It is he who sells the remaining life for the transitory life," he replied. Then he was asked, "Who is the most important of all the people?" "It is he who thinks that the world is not important," he answered. IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. There are many beautiful conversations and dialogues which we find in some of the historical texts. And in one of these historical texts, we find an interesting conversation between Imam Muhammad al-Baqir, peace be upon him, and his companions. And so in this specific conversation, in this golden dialogue, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam talks to his companions about how to treat people according to the rules of social conduct in Islam. One of the things that Imam al-Baqir talks to his companion in this dialogue, he talks about cheerfulness. And so Imam Baqir alayhi salam asked his companions and requested his followers to meet people with cheerfulness and good words. Imam al-Baqir at one point of the conversation says, "Good words and cheerfulness lead to love and nearness of Allah, while bad words, on the other hand, and frowning lead to hate and remoteness from Allah." In this very beautiful but very short and interesting conversation, we find that Imam al-Baqir was talking with his companion, and he told him these two very beautiful things. One, that if we use good words in our conversations, and if we are cheerful, we are happy, we have a smile on our face, These things lead to the love and the nearness of Allah. But on the other hand, if we use bad words, we use foul language, and we frown all the time, then this, in fact, dear friends, leads to hate and being far from Allah, being remote from Allah. And so despite those days when we are just in a bad mood, or as they say, we woke up on the wrong side of the bed, we must try extra hard and be extra careful to remain cheerful and have a smile on our face, to use good words, to be kind to each other. These, my friends, are the beautiful lessons which we learn from Islam, and specifically in this dialogue with Imam al-Baqir, alayhi salam. We invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
One or two, incidents from his life about his akhlaq, just to learn the seerah of the Imam, is the issue of, sabr, patience in dealing with the people who are rude to you. And we see this example in the life of the Prophet, in the life of Amir al-Mu'mineen, in the example of Imam Hassan, Imam Hussein, Imam Zainul Abideen. But since we are remembering the fifth Imam, let us look at his example, where somebody, and it seems, people had been brainwashed against the Ahlul Bayt. This individual was from Ahlul Kitab, either a Christian or a Jew, we don't know. And he was an Arab. We're talking about Ahlul Kitab from the Arab community. Knowing the Imam and his name and his laqab, his name was Muhammad alayhi salatu wassalam, but Baqir was the laqab, the title. So he knew that. So he comes and, when he met him, instead of addressing him the way he is addressed normally, he says to him, "Anta Baqar." Baqar means a cow. And Baqir is very different. According to historians, Imam was lenient. He smiled at him and he says, "Maybe you have forgotten my laqab. La ana Baqir. I am not Baqar, I am Baqir." So this person continued insulting the Imam. And he says to him, "Anta ibn al-tabbakha." Remember, we're talking about the Eastern society, especially among the Arabs. To insult someone's mother is the crossing of the limit. But see how Imam deals with this situation. Then he says, "You are the son of a woman who works in the kitchen, tabbakha, who is a cook." Again, Imam does not, he realized now this person is really after me, because he said Baqar and I said I'm Baqir. Now he is talking about me as Ibn al-Tabbakha. Imam still looked at him and said, "Well, at home, yes, she works in the kitchen. That's what she does as a wife and a mother. So what's wrong with that?" Imam doesn't respond or argue with him on that issue.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.